This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, more pressure on Australia's hotel quarantine system with two unusual COVID cases in New South Wales and in Victoria. Also, Australian journalist Cheng Lei is formally arrested in China, 6 months since she was first detained. And women who sit on company boards say that it's easier to be heard in a virtual environment.
Virtual meetings has given chairs the ability to conduct much more, you know, fairer, more participatory conversations. And hopefully they'll take that back into the boardroom when we start meeting physically.
Two more unusual hotel quarantine infections are keeping attention on the safety of Australia's system for isolating returned travellers. One person in New South Wales did not test positive until 16 days after their arrival home. And there's another mysterious case in a Melbourne hotel quarantine worker. Let's get the details from Samantha Donovan.
Until now, 2 weeks has been considered by most experts as long enough to ensure a return traveller was virus-free. But the recent decision of New South Wales Health to start testing people on day 16, 2 days after leaving quarantine, has already delivered a surprise positive result. The New South Wales opposition health spokesman, Ryan Park, says this may mean hotel quarantine stays need to be longer.
Well, I think the New South Wales government will now have to look at increasing the hotel quarantine stay. If we're getting cases identified on the 16th day, we cannot afford at this very delicate time of the pandemic to miss any more cases.
But the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, says there are no plans at this stage to extend the mandated quarantine period beyond 2 weeks.
The medical evidence will guide the decisions that we make about the length of quarantine. And so that is something that I know is under constant review by the AHPPC, the medical expert panel.
ANU infectious diseases expert Associate Professor Sanjaya Sananayake isn't convinced it's necessary to extend the hotel quarantine period.
I don't necessarily know if we have to do that. I think, first of all, it is important to work out that this individual wasn't infected in hotel quarantine, because we have seen those events happen more recently, and that could be a very plausible explanation about the incubation period. So in fact, it wouldn't be 16 days, it would be much shorter if it happened in hotel quarantine and more consistent with what we know about COVID. Now, if that has been ruled out, there are some other possibilities. Very occasionally, you get people who present outside the incubation period for whatever reason. These sorts of things happen. Then another possibility is that there could be a new strain that does have a longer incubation period. But again, if you are thinking about a more infectious strain, you would expect it to have a shorter incubation period because it's more infectious rather than a longer one.
In Victoria, health authorities are investigating the case of another hotel quarantine worker who appears to have followed all the rules but still got the virus. The woman in her 50s was stationed in the hotel foyer, not near guest rooms. The Victorian minister responsible for hotel quarantine, Lisa Neville, says the possibility it's another case of aerosol spread is being investigated.
Until we get the genomics, it really is too early to be able to make a guess, but we are doing the review of air conditioning regardless. We've changed already people wearing face shields. That was on infection prevention control. That commenced on Thursday. The meal deliveries have changed. So we've done all those changes that we know potentially might help us with aerosol spread.
It's the third case of possible aerosol spread in the Victorian hotel quarantine system in a fortnight. Ms Neville was again asked if that means hotels aren't the best places to confine people.
I still believe we have, you know, we've got police, we've got ADF, we've got testing of every worker, we've got all, you know, we've got the best infection prevention control people working for our program now. I think there is an element in which this is a changing virus. So this means we have to constantly review our program. That's what we're we're doing.
At the National Cabinet meeting on Friday, the Prime Minister backed Australia's hotel quarantine system. The Health Minister, Greg Hunt, says it's regarded as the gold standard by countries looking to follow it, like the UK. But he isn't opposed to the states coming up with alternative proposals, providing they're prepared to foot the bill.
It remains a matter for every state and territory if they wish to open additional facilities. Our concern is that they are safe and effective. We're supporting a potential significant expansion of the Howard Springs facility.
The Federal Health Minister, Greg Hunt. Our reporter there, Samantha Donovan. Well, South Africa's decision to withhold use of the AstraZeneca vaccine for now has raised questions today about what Australia should do with the 54 million doses it's bought. Authorities are highlighting South Africa and Australia are in very different situations, so the federal government says there'll be no changes to the planned rollout here. What sparked the change in South Africa is new research showing the AstraZeneca inoculation is not providing adequate protection against the new strain of COVID-19 that's emerged there. Political reporter Stephanie Boris has been looking at what that means.
After months of planning and preparation, South Africa has made major changes to its vaccination rollout. Health Minister Zweli Mkhize says 1 million doses of the AstraZeneca jab won't be issued to healthcare workers for now.
It is temporary until we figure out these issues. What are the next steps supposed to be?
South African authorities are concerned about new data which found the vaccine offers minimal protection against mild disease from the South African variant of coronavirus. The study involved 2,000 people and is yet to be peer-reviewed. Epidemiologist Professor Tony Blakely is from the University of Melbourne.
We are seeing mutations that not only are more transmissible, but by association are also developing some resistance to some of the vaccines.
He's backing South Africa's decision not to use the AstraZeneca vaccine at this stage, given the prevalence of the highly transmissible COVID-19 strain. So what does this mean for Australia, given that more than 50 million doses of that particular vaccine are set to be manufactured here? Professor Blakely says we're in a very different situation.
If we can keep the South African variant out by having good quality quarantine, and we can vaccinate all our population with very low virus levels, which is our case now, we can actually do a safe vaccination program and get the immunity up. That would be better than not doing it.
Pharmaceutical companies are already looking at how they respond to new strains of coronavirus. And as Professor Blakely explains, Australians may have to get booster shots further down the track.
But it's looking like it might be a bit like what happens with influenza. I'm guessing ahead here, but it might be that in a year or 2 years' time, those people who've had the AstraZeneca vaccine are likely to need a booster.
AstraZeneca is yet to be approved for use in Australia, but the Therapeutic Goods Administration is expected to endorse the jab soon. Federal Health Minister Greg Hunt wants the rollout to begin next month and says there's no changes to those plans at this stage.
The advice as of this morning from the Chief Medical Officer of Australia, Professor Paul Kelly, and the head of the Vaccines Task Force, Professor Brendan Murphy, is very, very clear, and that is there's currently no evidence to indicate a reduction in the effectiveness of either the AstraZeneca or Pfizer vaccines in preventing severe disease and death.
All data shows AstraZeneca remains safe and is highly effective in preventing serious illness from coronavirus. With that in mind, the vaccine rollout is set to see a shift in what the Australian government will tolerate. Prime Minister Scott Morrison recently indicated that down the track, the response to COVID-19 could be like the flu, where people get ill but recover.
The vaccination program over months, as it's rolled out, can change the nature of how Australia then manages the virus. And the point was made, it's less than about cases and as it is about presentations at ICU or seeking significant treatment, and that we can potentially move to a situation where we manage the virus potentially like other conditions that are in the community.
However, before that can even be considered, the vaccination rollout needs to begin. The first batch of Pfizer vaccines are expected to be given to some border, quarantine and healthcare workers within weeks. Amongst the complexities is the storage of the vaccine, with each vial containing multiple doses. Chief Nursing Officer Professor Alison McMillan says training is now underway.
The training is quite broad because it needs to meet the needs of quite a broad range of health professionals. particularly multi-dose vials, which need some special techniques in order to assure patient safety.
And to keep track on who gets which vaccine and how many doses, every Australian will have their details recorded on the National Immunisation Register.
Stephanie Boris with that report. You're listening to PM on the radio, on the ABC Listen app and via the podcast. I'm Linda Mottram. Ahead, a fresh push against one of the most loathed of Australia's taxes, stamp duty, with calls from the states to step up and drive economic reform.
Of course, it is politically very difficult. You have to expend some political capital, but you just cannot achieve any tax reform in Australia if you're not prepared to have some people unhappy.
China's government has moved to formally arrest Australian journalist Cheng Lei almost 6 months after she was first detained. Beijing says the high-profile TV anchor is suspected of illegally sharing state secrets overseas. Cheng Lei's family have spoken out for the first time since she was detained. Louisa Wen is Ms. Cheng's niece and spokeswoman for the family. She spoke to the ABC's 7:30 program.
Lei is a single mum with an 11-year-old and a 9-year-old. Currently, they're living in Melbourne with grandma. Grandma is mid-70s. I don't think she would have done anything to harm national security in any way intentionally. We don't know if she's just being caught up into something that she didn't know herself.
Louisa Wen, and more of that interview on 7:30 on ABC TV tonight. So why has this formal arrest taken so long? Here's our foreign affairs reporter, Stephen Jedgetts.
Well, Linda, under Chinese law, the authorities can essentially detain someone for up to 6 months for some charges, effectively disappear them without giving them access to their lawyers, I should add, and interrogate them. Now, this is pretty extraordinary. It comes under pretty critical, regular criticism, incidentally, from civil libertarians who say it's a terrible abusive process. Nonetheless, it means that people can essentially be disappeared under opaque legislation for a big period of time before they're even formally arrested. So that's what's happened here. Cheng Lei was actually detained almost 6 months ago, and it's only now that she's actually been formally arrested. And what that seems to signify is that the Chinese government does seem intent on pressing ahead full steam with this investigation.
And what do we know about the allegations they are making against her?
Very little at this stage. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokespeople said last year that she was suspected of endangering national security. We now have a little bit more detail that's leaked out over time and confirmed today. The allegation seems to be that she has taken some sort of information and then allegedly given that to an overseas source. So it seems to be a version of spying charges, if you like, that have been levelled against her. But exactly what that information allegedly was, who she gave it to exactly, how she got access to it, none of that is clear at this stage.
There's been a lot of speculation about why she's been detained. Can you perhaps flesh out some of the sort of the wider thinking around that?
Yeah, there's a lot of theories here, Linda, and I've got to speculate. These are, of course, all theories. No one knows for sure. One theory that emerged early on was that she was arrested simply because she was essentially too critical of the Chinese Communist Party. There'd been quite a few critical Facebook posts in particular that had been uncovered. So that was one theory. A second theory is that this came not long, of course, after the detention and then the expulsion of a number of Chinese state media journalists from Australia at a time when the relationship was spiralling to new depths. So this theory emerged that perhaps this was just diplomatic tit-for-tat, that she was being used essentially as a pawn or just to create some diplomatic leverage in the broader struggle between Australia and China. Both those theories still exist, but now a third theory has come into fashion, if you like, and that is that it may be that she's been caught up in a domestic political brawl. We saw recently another colleague of hers, a former colleague and a former friend of hers, who's an assistant for the Bloomberg news agency, also picked up and potentially facing similar charges. So that's a third theory that's been circulated, but the reality is we simply don't know at this point.
And it's been a week since the military coup in Myanmar. An Australian economic advisor remains detained there today, but of course lots of protests on the streets as well from the people of Myanmar. Do we know how the Australian government is likely to respond?
We don't know yet. Australia has a few levers that it can pull, but not many. We do know that Australia maintains a modest program of defence cooperation. We bring a small number of officers out to Australia for training. That program is currently under review, and there's a broad expectation it will probably be scrapped, but no decisions yet. Another prospect is that we might extend sanctions. We've already sanctioned a number of fairly senior Myanmar military people in connection to the genocide of the Rohingya people. It's possible that those could be expanded, but again, no commitment yet. The third thing we could do, we could take a look at foreign aid. The Foreign Minister, Maurice Payne, though, today said that she didn't want to gut programs that were largely beneficial to the people of Myanmar. So I think if we do move in this regard, we're more likely to target programs that specifically funnel money to the government of Burma rather than destroying the aid program as a whole.
Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts there. Well, Indian authorities are facing accusations they have failed to properly approve and monitor potentially risky projects after a weekend flood disaster that began high in the Himalayas, wiped out a hydro dam like it was so much Lego, and left dozens of workers dead or missing. Frightening videos emerged after part of the Nandi Devi Glacier apparently collapsed or broke off, sending a raging torrent of mud and rock-laced water hurtling down a sharp ravine, eventually inundating a second hydro dam and the construction workers building it. Now more than 2,000 soldiers and mountaineering experts are engaged in a second day of search and rescue efforts. Authorities are still pondering how it happened, but expert observers say that authorities have failed to take account of the impact of global heating while projects are approved as an act of prestige for politicians. Himanshu Thakkar is an environmental activist and water expert, and he's coordinator of the South Asian Network on Dams, Rivers and People.
What we can gather from the available information is that there was substantial amount of snowfall in this region last week. And on Sunday morning, when there was a bright day came about, and some of the accumulated snow started melting. At certain location, it possibly led to avalanche, and then it fell down into a glacial body that led to breaking off of the glacier. And this is all a paraglacial area, so there is a lot of debris already lying around there. So all of that started flowing down. It started flowing very fast, and it's also accumulated more debris on the way.
And is this something that could have been predicted? Do authorities have monitoring capabilities to check this sort of thing?
Exactly. So, you know, even a day after the event actually played out, we still don't know. We are speculating. We don't have authentic official information about the questions I asked in the beginning. We have the monitoring capacity, but we are not really monitoring. And that's a major lacuna. These are known vulnerabilities which has actually increased in the changing climate.
To what extent do you think we can attribute this disaster to climate change?
What we can see in this region, for example, is that in this part of Himalayas, the glaciers are melting faster than most parts of the world. Secondly, this area has been sort of starved of regular precipitation, but there has been more snowfall. Now, the February is not a month when the glaciers or the snow melts, but that particular day, suddenly it was very sunny and bright and it started melting. All of these are signatures of climate change, as the scientists are telling us.
Now, in the last few years, India's state governments have stepped up construction of hydropower and irrigation projects in the Himalayas. What is the scope of those plans? How big are they? And are they safe to proceed with?
It's known that these are hazardous projects in the sense that this is vulnerable to disasters, this area. When you build these hydropower projects, what you do is that you make major interventions into the river and the related infrastructure, which includes deforestation, which includes building of dams, tunneling and blasting and creation of huge quantities of muck, additional roads and townships, displacement of people with their traditional wisdom. So all of these increases the disaster potential in that area. And there is a huge plan of, in fact, what we call its bumper-to-bumper plan of building hydropower projects in this area.
Why then do India's governments, the state governments and the central government, feel it's so essential to press ahead if there are these dangers?
There is a whole political economy around it. Politicians feel very powerful when they have the power to sanction and take up development projects, huge development projects at huge expenses at one place. These projects are also known to indulge in a lot of corrupt practices, which leads to possibly kickbacks to some politicians.
You mentioned that the proper environmental and other processes are not being undertaken. Is that being challenged in any way, in the courts, in any other way?
Definitely, it's being challenged, actually. The very first project that got washed away, Rishi Ganga project, it was challenged in judiciary in the National Green Tribunal. And the National Green Tribunal appointed a two-member of a committee. That committee went and just certified that the project is okay. So this, so the, you know, judicial process is also a big problematic in India. And they feel that this is a technical subject in which they don't want to enter. But these are process-related issues in which we need proper assessment, public consultation process in which the local people have a role and in the monitoring and so on. In absence of all this, possibly these are big invitation to disaster.
So you would, with a degree of confidence, expect that more disasters are coming?
Absolutely. And not only this kind of projects and its violations and lack of monitoring, but also the changing climate is going to definitely increase the frequency and intensity of such events in days to come.
Himanshu Thakkar, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thanks a lot.
Himanshu Thakkar is coordinator of the South Asian Network on Dams, Rivers and People. Well, the Prime Minister has made it clear that reform is not on his agenda ahead of the next election. Observers noted that that was a particular feature of a speech he gave last week, kicking off the political year. Well, now there's pressure on the states to step up. The New South Wales Treasurer says after decades of watching the Commonwealth do all the heavy lifting on the reform front, now it's the state's turn. So what can and should they do? Here's Lexi Metherill.
Even ahead of the pandemic-induced recession, the Australian economy was in the doldrums. There was weak growth and wages were flatlining. In general, economists agree the hard start it needed then and still needs is economic reform. Brendan Coates leads the Household Finances Program at the Grattan Institute.
The reality is Australians' incomes have really not grown very rapidly over the last 10 years or so. And a big reason for that is that, you know, we haven't been making these kinds of reforms to boost productivity and raise living standards.
But after laying out his plans for the year at the press club last week, political commentators noted the absence of major reforms on the Prime Minister's agenda. Scott Morrison says he wants to get things done.
See, I'm not one that likes to pursue things for the sake of vanity. I like to get things done and not waste time on things that don't get done, because that doesn't help anybody.
So now, according to the New South Wales Treasurer, it's the time of state-led reform, after decades of the federal government doing the heavy lifting. Via the front page of the Australian Financial Review newspaper, Dominic Perrottet has issued something of a call to arms to his state and territory counterparts. He's quoted as saying many of the reforms that are going to drive substantial economic gains are at a state level. And he has support from just over the border, from the ACT Chief Minister Andrew Barr.
I support the call, and there is room for states and territories to reform their own taxation arrangement.
One of the first things that comes up at the mention of economic reform is stamp duty, the much-hated tax on buying a home. Economist Brendan Coates.
So stamp duty means that it's harder for people to move either when they're to housing that better suits their needs or if they need to move jobs. And so it means that people are living in the wrong parts of the city and can't access the whole labour market. So you're not going to take a job on the other side of town if it involves selling your house and paying, you know, $70,000, $80,000, $100,000 in stamp duty. It might be close to half or all of your annual wage in order to do so. And so people don't take those opportunities. The economy is much less vibrant. It's also really unfair. So the people who are hit hardest by stamp duty tend to be younger people that move more often.
The ACT government is the first jurisdiction to actually abolish stamp duty. It's almost halfway through its 20-year plan to phase it out completely. Andrew Barr says the state is already reaping the benefits.
The result of it has been an increase in the territory's gross state product, an increase in household consumption and investment in every year of the tax reform, and that's building cumulatively as each year goes by. So the economic theory has been demonstrated in practice to be absolutely correct.
The New South Wales government is also pursuing stamp duty reform, as Dominic Perrottet announced at last year's budget.
Stamp duty, by far, is the worst tax that we have. We've had theory after theory, report after report, that we should remove this tax.
Andrew Barr says getting rid of the tax comes at a cost.
You have to expend some political capital. There is no doubt that I have lost votes in some sections of the community because of these reforms. But on the flip side, I've gained votes from another section of the community who supports the economic outcomes and the social outcomes that come from this. But you just cannot achieve any tax reform in Australia if you're not prepared to have some people unhappy.
The Grattan Institute's Brendan Coates says the federal government could ease the pain of states losing the revenue they get from stamp duty.
By providing incentive payments to states that go ahead and do these kinds of difficult reforms. We did this during the 1990s with the national competition policy style reforms under Keating. It was very effective. You know, we saw states abolish a raft of taxes and fix regulations that were very costly to the economy. And by giving money to the states to help them do that, it can ease the political blow.
Brendan Coates is director of the Grattan Institute's Household Finances Program, speaking there with Lexi Metherill. Well, the head of the Tokyo Olympics sparked outrage last week when he said the inclusion of women on boards meant that meetings ran longer than they should because women have what he termed an annoying tendency to speak too much. There's no data from any country, including Japan, to support his thesis. Indeed, the opposite has long been true. Women have been underrepresented in boardrooms and often feel underrepresented in board discussions. But what's happening right now in boardrooms across Australia? What difference has a shift to a virtual boardroom brought for directors and, in particular, female directors? Rachel Mealy reports.
Board members of Australian companies, like the rest of us, had to adapt to a new way of life in 2020. Nicola Wakefield-Evans is a non-executive director who sits on five boards, including the Australian Institute of Company Directors. She says boards across the country have changed not only how they meet, but how often.
A lot more thinking around how the agenda should play out in a virtual meeting, a lot more shorter, more frequent meetings. So the long days, in my view, don't really work for virtual board meetings. So I'm seeing a lot of meetings change to being shorter and sharper and a lot of work's being done on the agenda accordingly.
She says the chairperson is key to how effectively the board operates in a virtual environment, and the technology can often lead to board members getting a better say than they would in person.
I've got one chair that's quite happy to receive text messages if somebody wants to raise something, so they're just running the meeting on that basis. And that curiously, that does work. You can't do that in an in-person meeting, obviously.
Women currently occupy a third of the board positions of Australia's listed companies. Nicola Wakefield-Evans says increasing that percentage is critical to having women's voices heard in boardrooms, but things have changed for the better in the past 12 months.
Virtual meetings has given chairs the ability to conduct much more, fairer, more participatory conversations. And hopefully they'll take that back into the boardroom when we start meeting physically.
Gay McGrath is an Australian businesswoman who sits on the boards of five companies, including Toyota Finance and IMB Bank. She agrees that the video conference has made board meetings more orderly, but she says the flow of conversation isn't as natural.
The chairs of meetings are very conscious of ensuring that there is a structure to the meeting, which is probably a lot more of a structure than you would find if you were meeting face-to-face in a boardroom. But sometimes that becomes quite stilted in the sense that when you're all sitting together, you can build on others' ideas and you can have more meaningful discussions. I think it's much harder when you're going around the screen and looking at individuals and calling on them to make their point. It's something as a director you have to be very conscious of, trying to not be just making independent points, but trying to build on insights or contributions of your colleagues.
The Institute of Company Directors asked its members last year if they would continue to use virtual technology when and if they were allowed to return to the boardroom in person. 90% said they would continue to use video conferences occasionally or frequently. Gay McGrath says running meetings online is a craft that needs practice.
Using the technology to get the benefit of the diversity of the perspectives around the table is something we just still have to keep conscious of, because as much as we would love to all get back physically in a boardroom together, we just know with the way things are going that you can't rely on that. So you have to work harder at those relationships and hearing those perspectives.
Gay McGrath, who sits on five boards, including that of Toyota Finance and the Steadfast Group, speaking with our reporter Rachel Mealy. I'm Linda Mottram. That is PM for today. You can always find us at the ABC Listen app and wherever you get your podcasts. That's where you should subscribe and leave us a review too. AM and The World Today are also there, so subscribe to them and leave them a review as well. Talk to you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. Donald Trump's second impeachment trial begins this week. And if you've been following the story so far, you probably think you know how this one ends, with the former president's acquittal. And you'd probably be right. But impeachment isn't the final chapter as far as Democratic strategists are concerned.
Today on The Signal, we're stepping you through Plan B to keep Donald Trump from running in 2024. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.